This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Elton John. He's still on his 3-year farewell tour, but he's managed to take a step back and examine his life and career in his new memoir, Me. He writes about his childhood, becoming a musician, songwriter, and performer, how he realized he was gay after he proposed to a woman, how saying yes to a line of cocaine led to addiction, one of several addictions along with alcohol and food, the rehab program that enabled him to get sober, the health scare that nearly robbed him of his voice, and other health scares that nearly killed him, and what it's like now to be married to his husband David and raise their 2 children. The recent biopic, Rocket Man, was a fantasy version of Elton John's life. The book is Elton John's more realistic account. Elton John, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the book. It's a pleasure to have you back on our show.
Thank you, Terry. It's lovely to be back with you.
So the book is a very candid description of your life. Before we get into some of the candid details that you write about in the book, you were in the band early in your career as the keyboard player in Long John Baldry's band. The band was called Bluesology. You tell this really funny story at the beginning of the book where he had just had a big hit. So now he was famous, and young women were coming to the concert and kind of like really getting excited and screaming. Yeah. And he says on mic, he says, why don't you say what he said?
Well, he said, they were grabbing the microphone. He said, if you break my microphone, you'll pay me £50. And I'm going, oh, John, that's not the way to handle this situation.
What did that teach you about stardom and how to handle it?
Not how to handle it.
Because
I got to this point where after Rocket Man came out, which was my first really big hit, about 2 years into my career after your song, I got screaming girls at some of my shows. And I just thought that was rather funny because I wasn't David Bowie and I wasn't Rod Stewart and I wasn't Mark Bolan and I wasn't Mick Jagger. But I was at the piano and I got screaming girls. But I thought, I'm not going to. Luckily, they couldn't reach my microphone because I was playing the piano. But you accepted it and you loved it and you just went along with it. I think John didn't know how to cope with it. He just really didn't know how to cope. For all his life, he'd been playing in clubs, playing the blues. And suddenly, young girls were screaming at him. And I just think, you know, he just never knew how to handle that.
Of course, also with you, when you had young girls screaming at you and everything, like you were gay, they didn't know that.
No. So. Well, he was gay, too.
Oh, and he was gay, too. Exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So what was it like for you knowing you were gay, knowing they didn't realize you were gay, and they were probably having all these like sexual fantasies about you? Yeah.
Well, I didn't worry about it. It's like, well, I'm not interested and you're not. You're interested, but I'm not.
Right.
But it was very sweet and they were very. I've still got a lot of. Most of my audience is a lot of women as well, a lot of girls and a lot of females. And I'm very grateful for that. But I just kind of think that once they did find out, I think a lot of girls still, you know, wanted to mother me and, you know, we can make you straight. We love you. We love you. And it's very touching.
Well, speaking of you and John Baldry, being gay, when you decided you were going to marry a woman when you were in your early 20s, he said to you, John, you're gay. You can't marry her. And what was your reaction? Because I don't think you had acknowledged that to yourself yet.
I hadn't. And I just thought, oh, my God. I remember where it was at the club. It was in Carnaby Street. And that's when Bernie and I came home that night and we were so drunk. And I told Linda, the girl I was going to marry, that I wasn't going to marry her anymore because I'd never had a sexual experience. I didn't know anything about sex. I'd never had a sexual experience at all. I didn't have a sex till I was 23, which was portrayed in Rocket Man. That was the first time. I didn't know anything about it. I presumed that you had to marry a girl because that was the way things were done. I didn't have sexual feelings for Bernie. I just had great love for Bernie. And I wanted to cuddle him and I wanted to give him a hug. I didn't want to go to bed with him, but I did love him more than I did love Linda. And when he said that, I suddenly start thinking, oh. Because I had no one in my family who was gay. I had no yardstick to measure my gayness on. Except I worked for Long John Baldry for so long, and he was so, when I look back now, he was so outrageous, and I didn't know anything, didn't think he was gay. I didn't know about anything. I didn't know about it. I was so naive. So that night, thank God, the epiphany came that night and I went home and, you know, dodged the bullet, as it were. But I still didn't have sex for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years later.
It's remarkable that you could be like a rock musician and remain a virgin until you were 23. You might be the only, the only person.
Well, it you know, a lot of rock musicians go into rock music to pull girls. That's one of the big attractions. Well, we can play on stage and we can flirt with the girls and then we can go backstage and then we can have them, we can take them home and we can have sex with them. That was never my motive. I was just wanted to play music. I wasn't, sex wasn't anything I was thinking about. I was just wanting to play music. I was so obsessed with music, nothing entered my head apart from that.
It sounds like a lot of your childhood years weren't great. Your parents bickered all the time. Your mother remarried, and you liked your stepfather, but they bickered all the time. They got married when she was 16 and he was 17. Yeah. You wonder if they ever should have been together in the first place. And your mother sounds like she was a very moody and frequently angry person who could hold a grudge. And you even describe how when you don't remember this, but I think it was an aunt who told you that when your mother was toilet training you, she'd beat you with a hairbrush until you were bloody, and she'd beat you until you used the potty.
Right.
So is that kind of typical of what your childhood was like?
But that was my mother who did that. My father and my mother should never have gotten married. They got married very quickly after the war. They were totally unsuited to each other. My dad was in the Air Force and was away a lot. My mum worked very, very hard in shops and also later in life at the Royal Air Force as well. And I was the product of, I don't know how many times they must have had sex. I don't think they must have had sex very often, but I was the product of their marriage. The 50s was an incredibly tough time to grow up in. It was after the war. It was very conservative. So if you were in a marriage and you wanted to get out of it, it was very tough to get out of it because divorce was frowned on socially. I knew nothing about sex, nothing. I was seen and not heard. Children were seen and not heard. I had the wonderful upbringing with my grandmother, and my mother could be so much fun, but she was mercurial. And they were like oil and water, the two of them. The nice thing about it is that when they did get divorced and my mother found Fred and my dad found Edna, it's that they found the love of their lives. That I'm very happy about. But the bit in between was hard to take because I dreaded my dad coming home because there would be a row immediately. And then I would retreat to my room, look at my books, look at my records, look at my toys. And funnily enough, I mean, I found love of inanimate objects because inanimate objects, which I kept in pristine condition, couldn't harm me or talk back to me. So I always loved collecting things.
What did you collect as a kid?
Books, records, toys, dinky toys, but mostly records and books, which I never lent out to anybody because I still have my books.
Well, you became an obsessive shopper later in life, and you collected everything.
Yeah, I'm an addict. It was the instigation of being an addict, but it was because I felt safe with the objects and not with my parents, and so, and it gave me a determination. With my dad not wanting me to be anything to do with rock and roll when Elvis Presley came in, I would be determined to prove to him that. My mother, who took my side and said, yeah, you should do what he does and let him do the music because he loves it, and was very supportive. My dad, of course, hated it. And I've been trying to prove to my dad that it's been okay ever since. So it gave me the determination to make something of myself. And it's just prolonged in my life. He's been dead for over 30 years, and I'm still kind of doing that. It's like, well, Dad, I hope you're proud now. And it's crazy.
He was an amateur trumpet player, wasn't he?
He was a trumpet player in a band, yeah.
Yeah, so why was he so set? I realize he didn't like rock and roll, but still he must have appreciated that you were such a talented musician, and you were studying classical music, too, at a conservatory.
I know. He just considered, there was an expression in called wide boy, which meant crook. He said, if I became a, Elton is, my mother read the letter to me, it's in a thing called Tantrums Neuron. Elton would become a wide boy if he carried, rock and roll is just, there's no future. He wanted a solid future for me in a bank or in the Air Force or doing a proper job. It was all down. You grew up in the 50s. You knew what it was like. It was when Elvis came, it was a revolution. It was a social revolution, and people were horrified. And people who in England were horrified, who had, conservative opinions of what was good and what was bad. That if I became a rock and roller, my life would fall apart. To a certain extent, he was right.
You could say that, but it also... let's face it, you've had an amazing life. He must have been so proud once he became famous and hopefully a little embarrassed that he tried so hard to discourage you from doing what you do.
No, not really. He never came to my shows. He never wrote a letter saying, well done.
He didn't even try to capitalize on your fame? Like, that's my son.
No. He had four other sons that he had with his married to Edna, and he was a tactile father to them and loving. He just, you know, I've done so much therapy and rehab, and I just look back on it and saying, this was an unfortunate meeting of two people who should never have met each other.
How were you introduced to cocaine?
I was in a recording studio in Colorado at Caribou Ranch, and I saw my manager, John Reed, sniffing something. Now, I was very naive up to the point. I didn't even know what marijuana was. I didn't know my band smoked marijuana. I'd never smoked marijuana. And I don't know what made me say. I said, what is that? And he was said, he was quite embarrassed. He said, it's cocaine. I said, what does it do? He said, makes you feel good. And I said, well, I'll have a go. Why I said that, I don't know. Anyway, I had a line of cocaine, which I threw up immediately afterwards because it made me feel nauseous and sick, and it was horrible. And then after I threw up, I said, can I have another one? Now, why on earth would anyone who needs sane, who was compos mentis, would want another line of cocaine after it made you throw up? But I did. And the thing with cocaine, it's very speedy, so it made me talk. And I was quite a shy person, so I thought, this is the drug that can open me up and make me feel relaxed and be able to talk to people. And of course, it was fool's gold. And that was the start of a love-hate relationship with it for 16 years, basically.
Did you think that it would make you more creative in your music, either in writing or performing?
No, but it was an aphrodisiac for me. But on the other hand, it's the aphrodisiac that couldn't perform. So, you know, this was the drug that made me feel horny, but I couldn't do anything about it.
Is that why you describe yourself as having become something of a voyeur?
Yes.
Kind of setting up scenes and watching?
Yeah, I became the Federico Fellini of sex scenes. I mean, yes, I'd like to watch.
Yeah, you say that in the book.
And I think that's probably why I didn't get HIV and I didn't get AIDS in the 1980s, because I didn't participate as much as watch.
Oh, that's really interesting. So in some ways it saved your life.
It did. Cocaine nearly killed me, but it saved me as well, because I liked to watch and it fulfilled my fantasies. So I didn't really participate in much sex.
And that was before you even knew about HIV?
Yeah. And then, of course, it happened so quickly, the terror of it all. And then, you know, the New York Times stories and John Reed's personal assistant, Neil Carter, died of AIDS very quickly. People started dying, and it was terrifying.
Did you ever fear that cocaine and alcohol were turning you into, like, the stereotype of the spoiled, entitled rock star?
Yes, of course. And that's what made it even worse. I mean, when Ryan White was in Indianapolis dying for that week, which I was there for,
people's memories, Ryan White was a boy who had hemophilia and got AIDS through a blood transfusion, and you became aware of him,
and I
you knew he
the
was
family.
A fan. You befriended the family.
I knew the family, and for the last week of his life, along with a lot of other people who were friends of the family, I was there in Indianapolis at the hospital, kind of being Jeannie White, his mother's secretary. But I used to come home to the hotel, and, you know, the thing about drugs is I always wouldn't ask for help because I knew I had a problem, and I knew my behavior was reprehensible. And I came home to the hotel in Indianapolis, and I would be so ashamed that these people who had been through hell, including Ryan himself, who never complained about it, his family who had been treated or ostracized by people in their community, forgave their people. I mean, the forgiveness and the Christianity involved in their actions, no hatred, no... It was unbelievable. I came home and I think, I complain here about I don't like the wallpaper, I don't like the furniture. And I said, what kind of person have I become? I've become the most despicable, horrible person. I complain about everything in my life. I'm so blessed in my life. These people have lost their son or losing their son, who has never complained about being the most unfortunate man in the world by contracting HIV through a blood transfusion. And here am I looking at everything and complaining about it. And I said, I really despise myself. And 6 months after Ryan died, I was sober.
I'm just thinking about the disconnect. I'm thinking about the disconnect between being on stage and having like thousands of people like screaming for you. Mm-hmm. At a stadium, tens of thousands of people screaming for you. And then being off stage and having to contend with your own problems, the things that you don't know how to do, your own insecurities and your own failings and your own extremes and everything. It seems like that must be really hard to connect, like the famous person who's so beloved and wonderful on stage with the flawed person who's off stage.
And that's why you escape into drugs or alcohol, and you just block it out. You block it out until the problem of the thing you're facing becomes such a monumental thing that you explode with rage. And that's the way I handled confrontation. I just blocked it out. I didn't deal with it until I had to deal with it. And then it was a very, very uncomfortable and painful procedure all the time. And I kept doing it time and time again. I hated my addiction. I hated the way I behaved. I hated how I treated people. I hated what I'd become. But I'm grateful that I had it, because then I learned how to become who I am now. And I'm proud of who I am now. I like who I am. I basically say I'm 29 years old, because I started to be a good person, or start to try and be a good person, or to behave properly when I was 43. And I know I was always a nice, kind person, but, you know, drugs bring out the darkness in you. The recovery, it wasn't when I was on drugs that was horrible. It was when I was off drugs, you know, the come down from it. Right. Alcohol is a major depressant. And I was drinking a bottle of Johnny Walker Black Scotch every day. Neat. And so no wonder I was angry. No wonder I was, you know, alcohol is a huge depressant.
How could you write songs that way?
Don't know. The only thing that was the constant, Terry, was that throughout all of this, I still wrote songs, because music was, again, saved my life. I love touring. I love writing the songs. I love recording, and sometimes not in the best circumstances and not in the fitness that I should have been in or the right state of mind. But it saved my life. If I'd have been the drug addict that I was and I'd just become a recluse and done nothing for 10 years, I wouldn't be here. I'd have OD'd. But because I loved, and I didn't take drugs constantly all the time, I would stop for 9 months. But whenever you go back to something you love, like cocaine, it gets worse every time you relapse and you take more. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the fact that I love the music, that also helped save my life by touring, making the records. I just still love the music. So it would remind me of how great my life was without the drugs. And I think I will get well. And then, you know, the madness of it all is, while I was thinking that, I'd be taking yet another line of cocaine. I will get well. Here's another line. I would have seizures in the middle of the night. Yeah. I would have seizures and people would find me on the floor and put me to bed. 20 minutes later, I'd be up doing cocaine again. I was blue from seizures. And I would put me into bed and say, we got to call the doctor. I said, no, I'll be fine. When they got out the door, I got the cocaine out again. I started doing it again. These seizures were horrible. They were really distressing. And that's how mad and how dangerous my addiction was. And I look back on it with sheer horror. And
Well, thank goodness you've been sober all these years.
I'm 29 years now. It's been wonderful.
It's a long
and
time.
I've learned so much.
So you're married. You have two children now. How long ago did you know you wanted to be a father? Because I'm thinking having the parents that you had wasn't the greatest role models sometimes.
No.
Like if you don't have great parents, it doesn't speak well for the nuclear family and you might not want one.
I never wanted to be a father. I never wanted to have children until I went to the Ukraine on a visit for the Elton John AIDS Foundation with David to an orphanage in Ukraine. And a young boy there who was 18 months old, called Lev, levitated towards me. Literally, he just jumped into my arms. And I carried him around for an hour and a half at the orphanage. He would not leave my side. He had a brother there called Artemis, who was HIV positive. And we stayed in the orphanage, and we were giving money to the orphanage and supporting them. And then I did a press conference. And one of the questions was, this little boy seems to be, who is now sitting on David's lap while I'm answering the question, this little boy seems to have been attracted to you. Would you ever think of adopting him? And I went, you know what? I've never, ever thought of adopting anybody, really, and this kid has stolen my heart. I would love to adopt him. Well, in the Ukraine, I was too old to adopt anything. I was gay. That was another strike against me. The Ukrainian laws was, you know, ex-Soviet laws, which was so, you know, so anti-gay and everything like that. But we tried. Even the adoption laws in Britain weren't great. And we tried for about a year and a half to adopt this boy and his brother. And at the end of the day, it became a national press thing where the press would go out and go to the, you know, find out who his mother was and his father was. And it became, you know, a farce. And David and I sat down and said, listen, the thing has become more important now to get these boys out of the... we can't adopt them, but we have to get them out because after a certain time, if you don't have tactile love, you know, it leaves a scar on you. And I said, we've got to get these boys out. They had a grandmother. We got them out to the grandmother in Donetsk, where they came from, and we surreptitiously looked after them. David then said to me, well, what do you think this boy was telling you? And I said, you know, my higher power, or God, whatever you want to call it, was telling me that it's nonsense. He was telling me, yeah, you can be a dad. You would love me. You'd be a good dad. And I said, I'd never thought that before. So David said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, you know, it's going to be hard to adopt. Let's have our own kids for a surrogate. So David did all the investigation, all the hard work, and we found a surrogate. We found an egg donor. And to cut a long story short, we had two children in 2 years from the same surrogate and the same egg donor, Zachary and Elijah. And again, serendipity plays a big part. If I hadn't gone to that orphanage, I would not have had children. And so that boy was telling me something. It was a messenger from the angels or whatever, and I truly believe that. And last year was wonderful because we got to meet them again and their grandmother, and it was so touching. We were in Kiev, and they walked in, and Lev came straight up to me, burst into tears. I burst into tears. And it was the greatest thing in the world. And they're just wonderful boys. And they're flourishing. Their grandmother's doing a wonderful job. We surreptitiously look after them still. We care about them. And but it's a wonderful story because those boys made me a father.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been such a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely to talk to you. Thanks.
Elton John has a new memoir called Me. Screenwriter and director Taika Waititi earned a cult following with comedies like What We Do in the Shadows and Hunt for the Wilder People. Then he directed the hit Marvel superhero movie Thor Ragnarok. His new film, Jojo Rabbit, is a satire set in Nazi Germany, and it features Scarlett Johansson, Sam Rockwell, Rebel Wilson, and Waititi himself playing an imaginary version of Hitler. Waititi is from New Zealand. His father's side of the family is indigenous Maori. His mother's side is Jewish. Our film critic Justin Chang has this review of Jojo Rabbit.
At a time when anti-Semitism and white supremacy are on the rise globally, I'm hardly opposed to the idea of a movie like Jojo Rabbit. The posters are billing it as an anti-hate satire, a flippant send-up of Nazi Germany that also pushes a message of love and tolerance. But for all its good intentions, I found the movie painfully one-note as comedy, bogus and manipulative as drama, with an archly whimsical visual style that feels like imitation Wes Anderson. It's the self-congratulation that rankles me most of all. Jojo Rabbit is so enamored of its alleged audacity that it doesn't realize how timid and conventional it is. The story, liberally adapted from Christine Lonen's novel, Caging Skies, shows us the final days of World War II through the eyes of a 10-year-old German boy, Jojo Betzler, who dreams of fighting for his country and making Hitler proud. Jojo is played by Roman Griffin Davis, a newcomer of such infectious charm that he quickly wins you over, even when Jojo starts spewing vile anti-Semitic nonsense. Sure, he's been severely indoctrinated, but look at what a good, adorable kid he really is, the movie seems to be saying. At Hitler Youth Camp, when his counselors order him to kill a rabbit with his bare hands, Jojo proves too gentle a soul to go through with it. And from that day forth, everyone mocks him by calling him Jojo Rabbit. he opens up about this humiliation to his imaginary friend, who takes the form of none other than Adolf Hitler, played by the movie's writer and director, Taika Waititi.
Poor Jojo. What's wrong, little man?
Hi, Adolf.
Want to tell me about that rabbit incident? What was all that about?
They wanted me to kill it. I'm sorry. I couldn't.
Don't worry about it. I couldn't care less.
But now they call me a scared rabbit.
Let them say whatever they want. People used to say a lot of nasty things about me. Oh, this guy's a lunatic. Oh, look at that psycho. He's going to get us all killed. I'll let you in on a little secret. The rabbit is no coward. The humble little bunny faces a dangerous world every day, hunting carrots for his family, for his country. My empire will be full of all animals. Lions, giraffes, zebras, rhinoceroses, octopuses, rhinoctopuses, even the mighty rabbit. Cigarette?
Oh, no thanks, I don't smoke.
Let me give you some really good advice. Be the rabbit. The humble bunny can outwit all of his enemies. He's brave and sneaky and strong. Be the rabbit.
You can appreciate the impishness of having Waititi take on the role of history's greatest monster. As the director himself said in a tweet, what better way to insult Hitler than having him portrayed by a Polynesian Jew? And while some have lambasted the movie for making comic light of Nazism, there is in fact a grand and honorable cinematic tradition of Hitler mockery, from The Great Dictator and To Be or Not to Be, to The Producers, with its immortal Springtime for Hitler sequences. I wish Jojo Rabbit were worthy of their company. Waititi's Hitler isn't offensive or outrageous. He's a slapdash, one-joke buffoon with barely enough comic dimensions to pad out a Saturday Night Live sketch. There's a similarly hit-and-miss feel to the other Nazi caricatures in Jojo's midst, like the hangdog Hitler Youth camp counselor played by Sam Rockwell, or his zealous assistant played by the usually hilarious Rebel Wilson. If a lot of the humor feels tacked on, that's because it's part of the movie's bait-and-switch. Jojo Rabbit isn't much of a comedy. It's more like a tearjerker pretending to be a comedy. The story's true dramatic agenda becomes clear when Jojo stumbles on a Jewish teenager named Elsa hiding in a secret room in his house. He's both scared and intrigued by Elsa, and a barbed but eye-opening friendship begins. Elsa is played by Thomasin McKenzie, the New Zealand-born actress who gave a wonderful performance last year in the drama Leave No Trace. She's very good here as a tough-minded survivor who forcefully dismantles every cruel lie that Jojo has been fed about the Jews. Scarlett Johansson is good, too, as Jojo's mother, who is sheltering Elsa and clearly isn't the loyal servant of the Third Reich she appears to be. But all the goodwill generated by these characters is ultimately undone by an emotional third-act twist that's been engineered to vacate your tear ducts. I found it so ghastly in its calculation that for the first time in this unfunny comedy, I almost burst out laughing. But Jojo Rabbit has its fans. It recently won the People's Choice Award at the Toronto International Film Festival, a prize that has often heralded the future winner of the Oscar for Best Picture. That's what happened last year with Green Book, and as different as the two movies are in form and subject, the comparisons are not entirely unfounded. Both movies use slick, crowd-pleasing comedy to confront the injustices of the past and leave you feeling better about the injustices of the present. Jojo Rabbit bills itself as a provocation, but what it's really selling is reassurance, a kid's perspective on war that treats the viewer like a child.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed the new film, Jojo Rabbit. Coming up, we hear from writer Attica Locke. Her new novel, Heaven My Home, is the second in a series about a black Texas Ranger investigating the criminal activities of the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Novelist Attica Locke writes, quote, "My bloodline runs along Highway 59 in East Texas," unquote. Highway 59 is a north-south route many African Americans traveled during the Great Migration, seeking opportunity in northern cities. But Attica Locke's family stayed. So did the family of Darren Matthews, the main character of her last two novels. The latest one is called Heaven, My Home. Darren Matthews is a black Texas Ranger investigating the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas. Set during the first weeks of the Trump presidency, the novel is about the tangled and complicated relationships of black and white families in East Texas, dating back to slavery. In Heaven, My Home, Darren Matthews is sent to Caddo Lake, an immense body of water, to help investigate the disappearance of a child. The missing 9-year-old is the son of an Aryan Brotherhood captain who's doing 20 years on drug charges. Matthews is conflicted about what it will mean to help find this boy. Will he turn out to be like his father? Attica Locke's first Highway 59 novel, Bluebird, Bluebird, won the Edgar Award for Best Novel in 2018. She's written 3 other novels and has been a screenwriter and producer on the TV show Empire and the Netflix miniseries When They See Us. She spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger.
Attica Locke, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Really love the new book. I'd like you to read, if you will, a passage from your new book, Heaven, My Home. And if you could just set it up for us, please.
Well, sure. This is a scene with our main character from this book and the first book, Bluebird, Bluebird, Darren Matthews. He's a Texas Ranger. It is December 2016. He's been going through a lot of stuff with his wife. He's had a bit of a drinking problem in the last book, and we find him now having been pulled off the road and being desk-bound as a concession to his wife so that their marriage kind of levels out. And then also we find him at this point in the story sitting around with a bunch of other rangers of color talking about what has been going on since Donald Trump was elected. One by one, they each acknowledge that something had shifted in the past 4 weeks, not just in the world at large, but on the job, too. They were dealing with things they'd never seen in their lifetimes, stories they'd only heard from the older men in the department, church burnings, the defacement of a mosque in Bryan, black and brown kids shoved in lunchrooms, spit on in gym class, a Mexican woman currently in critical condition after she was attacked in front of her husband and 3 kids. Buddy spoke of a hotbed of trouble near Jefferson in Marion County. He might have even mentioned a missing kid out that way, but Darren might have remembered it wrong. Things got a little fuzzy after that. He managed to go an hour before switching from beer to whiskey, but the slide was fast. It made wax of his spine. The liquor did. Made everything go soft at the edges, melting away all the departmental talk, all their tales from the field of which Darren had none. He was landlocked in Houston at the office these days. Bored in a way he was scared to admit to himself, afraid the word hit a deeper truth as blue as the record that was playing. Darren was depressed, sick with a rage that was eating him from the inside. Daily he marveled with befuddled anger at what a handful of scared white people could do to a nation. He never again wanted to hear them question the point of rioting in Ferguson or Baltimore or Watts or Detroit, for that matter. Hear them wonder why black folks would torch their own neighborhoods. Because in an act of blind fury, white voters had just lit a match to the very country they claimed to love, simply because they were being asked to share it. And that's the bit that stung, the hurt that cut bone deep. After years of being lulled into believing that the universe bent towards justice, he saw how little his friends and neighbors thought of his life, of his right to this country. After Obama, it was forgiveness betrayed.
So what inspired you to create the character Darren Matthews, this African-American Texas Ranger working in East Texas? He's investigating the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas right around the election of Donald Trump.
This whole book series for me was about Highway 59. It was about place before it was about a character, before it was even about stories. I come from both sides of my family, my mom's side and my dad's side, all come from little towns along Highway 59 in East Texas. And I grew up riding up and down this highway to visit family my whole life. And there's a sense of this highway being kind of in my bones. And I really wanted to tell a story or a series of stories about this part of Texas that people don't always think of. They think of Big Sky Country and the West and the Southwest. They don't always think of the craggy East Texas piney woods. And that's what I wanted to write about. So I had the idea for a book series of new stories. Every book would be a different story in towns along this highway. But it was presented to me by an editor, by my book agent. Well, that's great. But, you know, kind of the trope of the genre is readers are going to want to hang out with somebody for a while. So what's a character that's going to kind of take you into all of these stories? And I had to think for myself, who is a character that can move along Highway 59, which goes from Laredo to Texarkana? Who is that? You know, and it became quickly quite obvious it had to be a Texas Ranger because their job is literally to range. They have freedom of movement. And then what I had to do was confront the parts of myself that were very ambivalent slash unconfident, not sure I wanted to do, write anything about a cop. I don't quite see the world through the eyes of the establishment. I typically see the world through the eyes of outsiders. So it was a conundrum for me to figure out how to write this character. And I kind of found my way. I read a book called Ghetto Side by Joe Leovi. And it was a pivotal read for me and a pivotal read in terms of what it meant to write a black law enforcement officer. And Ghetto Side predates language like Black Lives Matter, but there is a black cop in that book who is saying that, yes, we all talk about the over-policing of black life, but the other story of the founding of this country is the under-policing of crimes against black life. And I'm going to wear a badge and stand up for black folks so that they're protected and crimes against them are prosecuted fully.
So Darren sent to Caddo Lake to investigate the disappearance of this 9-year-old boy, Levi, who's the son of a captain of the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas. This guy is serving 20 years in prison for drug-related charges, but not for the murder of a black man and who is a father of two. And Darren has some real conflict about how he feels about this boy. He thinks to himself, you know, what's going to happen if I save this boy? Like, is he going to grow up to be like his father? Will I see him in 10 years with Aryan tattoos on his neck? Or, you know, is there a chance that his life could turn out differently?
Well, that's the fundamental question. And I think I was asking myself that on the other side of Trump's election. You know, I'm 45, and basically the course of my life has looked a very particular way. I live on the other side of the civil rights movement. All of my understanding of everything and race in America is post-civil rights movement. So it has always kind of looked like this slow march, difficult struggle, sometimes violent, sometimes heartbreaking, but a march toward justice and equality. For the most part, over the course of my life, it has looked like we were living King's dream. And Obama seemed to be a kind of culmination of that. Not the end point, but a beginning of seeing a really different way this country deals with race. The election of Donald Trump so fundamentally shifted that narrative for me that I just felt kind of lost in a lot of ways. And I started realizing I had been walking around thinking that essentially racists were all going to kind of die out. But I realized, oh no, they might be regenerating. It's possible that this is being passed on into other generations. And I started asking myself this question of whether or not that process could be stopped. And so finding this missing child in this book becomes a metaphor for, can the child literally be saved? But can he be saved from the racist thinking that is around him?
And so Darren, when he's thinking about this white boy, Levi, is also thinking about himself and what he was like at 9. And he also didn't grow up with his father. And he was actually very distant from his mother and was and grew up with some very supportive uncles. And he kind of wonders, you know, what his life would have been like without them.
Yes, he's able to feel compassion for this child at the same time as a kind of fear that what if I get this wrong and I end up saving this kid only for, because we find out that this child is starting to act out the stuff he's seeing around him.
Right.
His mom is living with this wannabe Aryan Brotherhood guy, and the kid is starting to do things like spray paint epithets on walls and, you know, not be kind to black neighbors. And there's a sense of, well, my God, if I save this kid, is he going to be, is it safe to save him in a strange way? And, you know, I had finished this book before I realized where this child came from in my psyche. Around the election, my daughter's 12 now, but in 2016, my daughter goes to a super, super, super progressive Southern California school. And there was a white kid there that called a black kid the N-word. And I was simply stunned. that I had fallen into this kind of lull that I was in Southern California. I was in this progressive state. I was in this progressive school with my child. How did this word find its way into her life? And my reaction to it versus my daughter's reaction to it were completely different. My daughter, well, let me start with my reaction. I was furious. Mm-hmm. I was hurt. I was enraged. I was like, I don't want to have anything to do with this kid. I don't want to have anything to do with this kid's parents. I don't want them to sit next to me at back to school night. I don't know what to do with this. Whereas my daughter's reaction, because her relationship to the word is different, she knows it's wrong. But she also was able to see that child in a larger context. Was stuff going on in his home? She said, Mommy, I kind of feel sorry for him. I don't know what's going on or where that came from, but I feel sorry for him. But I was not willing to forgive, and I was very uncomfortable that I, the adult, was not willing to forgive this child. And it's taken, we probably had 20, 25 dinner table conversations about this. Mm-hmm. And I knew that the child ultimately felt a great deal of remorse. And it was up to me to be the bigger person and to potentially forgive this child for this. And to not put on what he did, what that word means to me, and what it means to me when I was called that word at that age. I was called the N-word at about 9 and shot with a BB gun. So for me, the word is connected with violence. It's connected with such ugliness. And I don't know why that kid said what he did, but I was feeling that it wasn't quite fair for me to put my entire history of that word going back into the 70s on this child today. It was just, all of that was roiling in my mind. And that's where a lot of this came from, this question of, is it safe to forgive folks? Or are we... is that there's something dangerous in forgiveness.
We'll get to forgiveness in a little bit, but you were shot with a BB gun?
I was. I was about 9 years old. I was living in the suburbs in Houston, and I was really good friends with this white kid named Blake. We used to play Fort together because this was a suburb that still had empty lots. They were still building new houses, and we would play and build forts in these empty lots, and we were just buddies. And one day I came out of the house, and he was just all the way down at the end of the block, and he said, Attica, come here. And I, like, walked out towards him, and as I got closer, he had a friend that was hiding in the bushes that then popped out and pointed a rifle at me and shot. And I was stunned. It broke skin. I bled. So I didn't understand at first that it was a BB gun. I thought I had been shot. And I stumbled home bleeding. And my parents went crazy. They were so angry. And it was a very similar feeling, I mean, that I just described about my child. But it was Texas in the 80s. They had marched. They had done all these things. How had they arrived in this suburban community only for their child to be called the N-word? And I believe that the police were called on this child. I have a vivid memory of sitting in the car while my mother went into this child's father's place of business and basically just cussed him out. But what I also remember about that time is that neither of my parents, God bless them, ever actually sat down and said, Attica, how are you doing with this? They were so caught up in their own hurt that that took precedence over checking in with their child. And I guess I didn't want to do that this time around with my daughter. So I asked her how it felt for her to hear the word. And I listened to her feelings about it. And that played a part in me being willing to consider forgiving this child because my daughter was not wounded to the degree that I was 30-something years ago.
So we were talking about this ambivalence that Darren Matthew has with his job as a Texas Ranger. And a lot of that is played out between these two uncles that raised him. One of his uncles, William, who actually died in the line of service as a ranger, he believes that, can you describe the two ways that these uncles think about the role of law and justice in the lives of African Americans?
Yes, they are two identical twins. I grew up with identical twin great uncles who were very different. One was a colonel in the army. The other one was a professor. And that gave me the kind of idea for this. And what it also afforded me was a way to look at the fracture in the Black psyche between a character like William, the former ranger, who believed that the law is the thing that could save Black folks. That if you had more people like him, more people of color wearing the badge, then you could have people protecting Black life. You could have people making sure that crimes against black life are prosecuted to the same degree that crimes against white life are prosecuted. Whereas his twin brother, a former criminal defense attorney, says, no, the law is a lie that was written against us. We need protection from it. And that kind of polarizing split is inside of Darren's mind. And that gave me freedom as a black woman to write about a black cop, because I could play with that ambivalence that I feel as a human being and as an American.
You know, a lot of this book is about forgiveness. One of the main characters, Leroy Page, says to Darren a couple times, black folks are the most forgiving people on earth. And the first time he says it, Darren can't quite tell if he's saying it with pride or shame. But the next time he says it, it's clear that there's a lot of bitterness in his voice. And you write that Darren's uncles, these two very supportive people who raised Darren, often debated ferociously whether forgiveness made black folks saints or stooges. Why were you thinking about forgiveness?
I was thinking about the fact that Donald Trump will one day be gone. He won't be around forever. But I still have to live with the people who put him in office. I still have to share this planet and this country with people who showed such a profound disregard for my life and the life of other people of color. And I don't know what to do with that. And I think I was asking myself, could I and should I, when all this is said and done, forgive the people who put Trump in office? Is that safe to do? Or do you forgive people at your own peril because you give them then license to keep this up? Because like the passage I read earlier, I was one of the people who thought when Obama was elected, not that we were going to wipe history clean, but there was a willingness in my heart to start new. We could remember what happened before, but we could start new today. So I was so profoundly hurt to realize that there were still so many people in the country for whom they were fine electing someone who said such hateful things about people who look like me, just because it made economic sense to them. I don't know what to do with that, and I'm still wrestling with forgiveness. I don't know how or if to forgive.
Well, Attica Locke, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Attica Locke spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Her new novel is called Heaven, My Home. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.